Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener-supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
This is Jim Petzer, your host on The Raw Deal, right here on Revolution Radio, this 25th day of March, 2021. I expect to be joined by Peter Kirby from California, where we're going to be discussing the situation in San Francisco and other cities in what was once known as the Golden State, but is turning into something like a human garbage dump. I begin with the report. Four men charged in Moscow attack showed signs of beating at a hearing. Court says to accept guilt. Here we go, Moscow. Four men accused of staging the Russian concert hall attack that killed more than 130 appeared before a Moscow court Sunday on terrorism charges showing signs of severe beating. One appeared to be barely conscious. Court statement said two of the suspects accepted their guilt, though the men's condition raised questions whether they were speaking freely. There's been conflicting reports in Russian media that three of the four had admitted culpability. Investigator charged Maldursan Mirzarev, 32, Sadik Karam, Rasha Balazoda, 30, Shamsiddin Fariduni, 25, and Mukhammada Sorab Faizo, 19, with committing a terrorist attack, resulting in the death of so vastly many. The offense carries a max sentence of life imprisonment. All the men were identified as citizens of Tajikistan. They'll be held in custody until May 22nd, pending investigation. They were heading for Ukraine for safety when they were captured. I don't think there's any doubt this is a CIA Ukrainian terror operation. Victoria Nuland, during a speech in which she announced that she was going to be retiring, said that Russia was in for some nasty surprises. Well, this appears to be numero uno in the list of nasty surprises. We also report of the Russian fleet having been hit hard. Get this. A striking new development of the victim extracting a heavy toll on the attacker. I don't think that's right. And in battle, Ukraine has inflicted, described here as catastrophic loss at Putin's Russia by destroying two more massive vessels of the Russian Black Sea fleet, leaving it with none of its vital landing ships. More than 2 years after it was invaded by the Russian military to correct, after Russia conducted a special military operation to prevent the slaughter of the Donbass, which is about to occur, Ukraine has successfully targeted the last two of the Russian Navy's amphibious vessels in the Black Sea. The Ukrainian military confirmed the attack on the large landing ships alongside a communications center in Sevastopol, a city in Crimea, and various other infrastructure components. Now, bear in mind, CIA, as even the New York Times has acknowledged, has been basically running the shop since 2014, when, of course, the coup that overthrew the Russia-friendly president was executed by Victoria Nuland, using $5 billion in American taxpayer money to install a Western puppet, of whom Zelensky is the successor. You can anticipate Russia's not going to take any of this kindly. There's going to be very serious consequences, in my opinion. Meanwhile, consider this gruesome. The IDF admits they run a telegram channel where they laugh and mock Palestinian civilians and children with snuff films of them being killed. And yet this is being called the most moral army in the world. What an insult. Here we have a report about
peg against Israel. The IDF has been forced to admit that they have been running a propaganda channel on Telegram aimed at Israeli citizens that featured snuff films of Palestinians being murdered, dehumanized as insects and vermin, their bodies desecrated, and the destruction of Gaza glorified. Here are the details. The channel named 72 Virgins Uncensored celebrated everything from a Palestinian being repeatedly run over to a mother grieving over her son to the destruction of places of worship and reduction of Gaza City to rubble. The existence of the channel has been known for some time. It was created on October 9th. Haaretz was the first mainstream outlet to cover its existence in early December of last year. Now, in that first report, they were able to cite a senior military official who anonymously confirmed that the IDF was, in fact, directing the channel. At the time, however, the IDF denied those claims. Now, in a follow-up, the IDF has been forced to admit that their own propaganda unit was behind 72 Virgins the whole time. Here is Haaretz with that reporting, quote, reversing an earlier denial, Israeli military officials have admitted that the Telegram channel 72 Virgins Uncensored was operated by members of the Department of the Israeli Defense Forces Operations Directorate. The admission comes after Haaretz published an expose on the channel last month, which led to an internal investigation into the matter. The probe, conducted by Major General Oded Basiak, head of the Operations Directorate, found that the information that led to the original denial that the channel was operated by or on behalf of the Army was incorrect and relied on...
How about that? Meanwhile, I just had a call. I was seeking to follow up on the reports about the attack on the Russian fleet. According to RT, Russian sources, the ships were not sunk after all, but rather that the incoming missiles were taken out. Hope to have further development here to expand upon this. Meanwhile, Trump's bond has been reduced to $175 million from that staggering over $500, where Trump actually had said he had the money. But here's a very interesting report. Constitutional attorney explains why Letitia James won't seize properties. Former president to get the last laugh. This is actually very simple in a baked-in strategy of the wealthy. Own nothing and you'll be happy. Let me explain. The great financial teacher Robert Kiyosaki once explained that wealthy people don't really own anything, at least not in their own names. Wealthy people control things they want to own through LLCs, shell companies, business entities, charitable remainder trusts, corporate structured partnerships, and more. Some of the greatest insurance anyone can buy is the asset protection corporate structures and business arrangements provide. President Trump is no stranger to this. Not a single wealthy person living in modern times is. Which is exactly why Letitia James likely won't be able to seize his assets. Constitutional Attorney Jonathan Turley. I've been waiting to hear from Jonathan. I admire him so. Recently appeared on Fox to explain in greater detail, simply put, because President Trump owns his properties through complex partnerships and corporate structures, they likely won't be seized. They just don't belong to him. Take a look at what he has to say. Jonathan Turley pours cold water.
Contributor. So, Jonathan, give me your off the top of your head. Where do you think this stands? I mean, in basketball terms, this is March Madness. The 24-second clock is winding down, if that's what college has. He's down, I think he's close to 5 seconds, and the ball is still outside the three-point shooting line. So what do you reckon happens next, right now?
Well, it's hard to gauge because of that posting by the former president. That's going to take some pressure off of the Court of Appeals because they're going to be aware that he's saying that he may have the cash. Mm. And so it'll be interesting how that dynamic plays out with the court. This is a lot of money to be able to get his hands on, even for someone who's a billionaire. The question still remains for the Court of Appeals, the underlying decision, and possibly this bond issue. In my view, the penalty that was handed down is absurd. You know, I don't know anyone that can make sense out of the figure that this judge came up with. He might as well have just said $1 trillion. And by making it a big number, he made it likely that Trump would have to sell some of his real estate. Because you can't use real estate to float a bond of this size. Mm. Now, that may have been avoided, but I think that all of the drama going up to the appellate review has got to help Trump to some extent. I think that even people that don't like Trump did not like what they were seeing here. There are very few people that could come up with this amount of cash in this short of time. And if he hadn't, and maybe he still won't, it could put his appeal in danger. So the judge could set a figure so high that unless he sold the property he's trying to protect, he can't get anyone to review the decision.
Yes, well, a famous lawyer I know called it mob justice. I don't want to name any names, but a very famous lawyer who appears on TV quite frequently. Jonathan, what do you think that Mr. Trump's attorneys have already filed an appeal to the New York appellate court?
Well, they've started that process. This is going to move up there. Essentially, the trial court just issued another condition of supervised release, or not supervised release, but supervision for 3 years. What was interesting about the court's decision is that should have been the full extent of the overall decision. That is, if he still believed that in this victimless crime where no one lost a dime, that you couldn't trust the corporation, you could have just kept the corporation under this type of monitoring. You didn't have to impose a dollar, let alone $500 million worth of penalty on this defendant. And so it just begs the question again of, well, why hit him with this unprecedented penalty?
No, absolutely. It seems crazy. He's got to give up everything he owns just in order to appeal. Sounds very un-American. Jonathan, a technical question. Worst case for Trump or worst case or whatever, if AG Letitia James seizes a property. Now, there's been stories in the paper today, New York Post and elsewhere, that she's got her eye on Mr. Trump's golf club in Westchester County. If she seizes a property, Jonathan Turley, can she sell the property, just sell it off right away?
It's not that easy. And I think that James is going to find out this is far more complex than she's suggesting to New Yorkers. I mean, James hasn't built anything but her career in her life. Mm. I mean, this is complex finances. Right. And most of these properties are partnerships. They have leveraged debt. All of that has to be unraveled. So these aren't just this one-to-one Trump versus James type of equation. So in order to seize that property, she's going to be pulled into court. There's going to be challenges. It's not going to happen overnight. Where everyone is celebrating this idea that she's going to padlock Trump Tower, it's not likely to happen and certainly not likely to remain very long. The other thing is that she could be harming the value of the property that she's trying to seize with some of these actions. I don't think that matters to her, but it might matter to a court.
Yeah, well, it might matter to, you know, anybody else that's been in business or commerce, but that's a separate segment. Jonathan?
The whole case, of course, is a manifest absurdity. Trump did nothing wrong. There were no victims. He gave an appraisal of his property. The banks were entitled to make their own assessment as they did with their own assessor. So Trump, perhaps overvaluing his property, as the judge claimed, by grossly undervaluing the property, did not commit any crime. The whole case was absurd, where the judge found him guilty. And then we turn out to have going forward to try to seize a property really outrageous. Here's something that's going to blow your mind. Illegal alien lists all the things New York City is giving him for free. New York City giving him for free. YouTuber Nick Shirley has posted a man in the street interview with an illegal alien in New York who detailed the shocking amount of goods and services he's receiving at taxpayers' expense. The interview began with Shirley asking the migrant how long he'd been staying at the Watson Hotel and if he had to pay for it. 2 months. No, we don't pay it. It's totally free. It is a help that the state gives us, the migrant says in Spanish. He also details the good services he given at the hotel, including free breakfast, lunch, dinner, everything. Nick Shirley has tweeted about it. In New York City, migrants were already receiving free rent, free food, and now they're receiving free lawyers, free Medicare, and free flights. This is insane and unfair to American citizens, no doubt about it. He continues. Do you also receive insurance for medication, Shirley asks? Yes. They are in charge of doing all that. In fact, they process Medicaid, he says. He continues to explain they provide with free lawyers. They begin the process of applying for asylum, also free. His family and he have luggage, so he asks where they're heading. Well, we're now heading, in fact, we asked for the tickets, and they also gave them free, and we're going to Arizona, to Phoenix, Arizona. And they give you that for free? Yes, it's free. It's free. The flight is completely free. We are living because here in New York, as we know, it has collapsed. They're inside the hotel. Did they coordinate all this? Yes, they coordinate all this. Unbelievable. And as don't think this is by accident. This is by design. Over 200,000 deportation cases dismissed after Biden regime failed to file the required paperwork. Of course, you let people in on the grounds they're going to be subject to court review as to whether their presence in the United States is legal and allowable or not, and then you simply don't do the paperwork. A staggering number of over 200,000 illegal immigrants have had their deportation cases dismissed as DHS has reportedly failed to file the necessary legal documents in a timely manner. This information comes from a recent report published by the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse at Syracuse University, according to the New York Post. The track report released Wednesday includes data through February of 2024, just last month, highlights a systemic issue where thousands of notices to appear have not been filed with immigration courts ahead of their scheduled hearings, rendering the courts unable to proceed with deportation cases and rule on asylum claims. These large numbers of dismissals and what then happens raise serious concerns, the report emphasizes, calling out the almost total lack of transparency on the part of DHS regarding the reason behind these failures. Namely, they want all the illegals to be here. They're merely offering sops to pacify the public by claiming that they're going to have formal hearings and evaluate it for whether or not they're legally present in the United States. That's all a sham, a complete sham. Here's another one you're going to love. We want it now. Black clergy demand $15 billion in reparation from white churches in Boston, and they want it now. Black clergy in Boston are demanding a $15 billion reparation package paid for by white churches in the local area. The demands were made during a press conference, the Resurrection Lutheran Church, organized by the Boston People's Reparations Commission, according to the Globe. Among the speakers, Reverend Kevin Peterson, who previously led a campaign to rename the popular tourist site of Fannie Lou Hall because of the name's links to a slave owner. We call sincerely and with a heart filled with faith and Christian love for our white churches to join us and not be silent around this issue of racial and slavery and commit to reparations. We point to them in Christian love to publicly atone for the sins of slavery. And we ask them to publicly commit to a process of reparation where they will extend their great wealth, tens of millions among some of those churches, into the black community. Also speaking at the event was Daniel Williams, director of a social justice group called Prophetic Resistance Boston, who claims her great-great-great-grandmother was a slave in North Carolina. Black people, the descendants of slavery, have been washing the feet of our oppressors for well over 400 years, Williams reportedly said. Now it's time for you to wash our feet. We, the descendants of slavery, want our reparations. We want them now. Well, they may be waiting a while. Meanwhile, get this, and I have a dear friend who thinks this is exactly what's coming to the United States. Scotland's Hate Crime Act is an authoritarian monstrosity. The SNB woke censorship is fueled by fear and loathing of ordinary people. Get this. Then before you know it, you committed a hate crime. These are the words of the hate monster, a fuzzy orange cartoon character designed by Police Scotland. A video featuring said monster was released earlier this month, part of an awareness-raising campaign for the new hate crime act that's coming to force in Scotland on 1 April. And no, this is not an April Fool's Day joke. The hate monster is said to live inside all ordinary Scots. According to the video, when you feel insecure or angry, the hate monster can grow and overwhelm you to the point of make you want to have a go at somebody and vent your anger. Because folks act or look differently from you in the eyes of the Scottish authorities. The average person is just one moment away from making a hateful outburst or launching a violent attack against a minority. The Hate Crime Act has two main provisions. First, it'll turn any crime into an aggravated offense if it's deemed to have been motivated by prejudice, resulting in a harsher sentence. Second, most significantly, it will make it a crime to behave in an abusive manner intended to stir up hatred against groups with certain protected characteristics. The law extends an existing provision against stirring up racial hatred set out in the UK Wide Public Order Act of 1986 to cover matters as diverse as religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity. Those found guilty of wrongthink under this provision can be punished with an astonishing 7 years in prison. Can we get the hate monster to play? No. Worry not about it. Meanwhile, DC Dave has put together a song about the wrong enemy. It's entitled Sucked Into Fighting for Jews. Why are we not hearing it? Let's see. Are we going to hear it?
I got the feeling that something's not right. Ain't no reason why I need to fight. Just because they had a bad day, I keep wondering why I have to pay. New York Times to the left, Fox News to the right. Here we are, sucked in the fighting for Jews. Yes, we're sucked in the fighting for Jews. And I'm wondering what it is I should do. They want us all filled up with hate, but I just want food on my plate. Fools to the left of me, suckers to the right. Here I am, sucked in the fighting for Jews. Oh, it's dark, all it coming, Truman caved into the plane. But suckers never stop asking, hold up a hand and say, please. Finally make some sense of it all, but I can see it makes no sense at all. Is it cool to just lay down my gun? 'Cause I don't think that I'm helping anyone. Fools to the left of me, suckers to the right. Here I am, sucked in the fighting for Jews.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, if those stories don't curl your hair, we got more coming out of California. As I said, once known as the Golden State, I myself was born in Pasadena. I grew up in Southern California in the 40s and the 50s. It was magnificent. You had the ocean, you had the mountains, you had the desert. It was not so hugely overpopulated as it is today. We have not seen the emergence of Montezuma's revenge, as it's known, where Hispanics are retaking land they claim still to belong to Mexico. I have a special guest today who knows a great deal about what's going on, especially in that once known as the jewel of the world, one of the most beautiful cities, San Francisco, Peter Kirby. I'm simply delighted to have Peter with me here today. Welcome to the Raw Deal, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Peter, I just want to open up to your thoughts about all the migrants, all the activities going on, all the crime, all the shoplifting, whatever you think is most important Americans should understand about what's happened to California, my friend.
Yeah, well, California has been taken over by a radical faction of the Democrat Party, and it all started in San Francisco with Phil Burton in the 1950s. And before we get into everything, I just kind of want to introduce myself a little bit. If you've heard of me at all, you've probably heard of me in the context of my work on chemtrails. I've been on Jim's show before, talking about chemtrails, and been on a lot of other shows. I have a book, Chemtrails Exposed, the New Manhattan Project, that's sold pretty well over the years. And but now, see, and you know, when I would do other interviews about the chemtrail stuff, people would start talking about politics, and I would shy away from it because I hadn't done the research. Because, you know, I follow the news and stuff, but you know, I hadn't really dug deeply. I didn't feel qualified to really speak on politics so much per se, but now I've done the research, and it mostly specifically pertains to San Francisco, of course. But the what's happened in San Francisco definitely is a microcosm of what's happened throughout California and throughout America. So this is my first fully political interview, and I thank you again, James, for giving me this opportunity to talk about this.
Well, I'm delighted, Peter, and we'll want to return to a chemtrail issue for updates as we proceed, but go right ahead about the current state of California and its descent into a human garbage pit.
Yeah. Well, let me just kind of sum it up as to what happened. There's more details to it, but basically Phil Burton in the late 1950s established a political machine in San Francisco that to this day runs San Francisco. But not only did he take over San Francisco with a bunch of other politicians, most notably today Nancy Pelosi is a direct descendant of the Phil Burton political machine. But he was very active statewide. You see, he came from the Midwest originally and came to San Francisco, but then he went to college down in USC, University of Southern California, where he established a lot of political connections down there. So from very early on in his political career, he was influential on a state level in California. And he lost his first election to a dead man by more than 2-1. He was going up against the what was basically the Irish political establishment at the time in the early 1950s in San Francisco. There's kind of fascinating story about that in the biography of Phil Burton. The only one that I found that's really worth reading is called A Rage for Justice. I forget the Jacobs is the author's last name. He goes on about in this book, he goes on about the previous political dynasty that had been ruling San Francisco. And this was ruled by a guy by the name of William Malone. And he occupied a certain state Senate seat that was, I forget the number of the district, but it was like the Mission District, which used to be the Mission District of San Francisco used to be pretty much all Irish people. And now and then and actually it's been changing a lot over the years. When I was in high school, it was pretty much all Latino. But now that there's gentrification, they call it, going on. So it's going back to white people in part. But there's still a lot of Latin people in the Mission District. But anyway, Phil Burton the first office that he won was a statewide office. He lost that first election when he was living in the Mission District, trying to go for that state assembly district. He lost that one badly, and then he moved to another assembly district in Nob Hill. He lived in Nob Hill, and then he first got success by courting the Chinese vote in Chinatown, which was part of his district. And so from there on, he was practicing identity-based politics. And so what happened here, he had great success doing that, and he started bringing in his brother and his wife. They all ran for office and won. Sala Burton, John Burton. To this day, John Burton is on the San Francisco Port Commission. But he had tremendous success doing this and began winning in landslides. And, you know, there were racist things going on. There was systemic racism at that time. In the late 1950s in California and in San Francisco, there were racist laws and racist practices going on. This is well documented. And, you know, in my opinion, it was a good thing that these things were eradicated. This was a whole process that was going on over the whole country. And this started with the abolition of slavery and all this. And but Phil Burton seized upon the last remnants of systemic racism that was going on. And his people eliminated those things, and that was great. But see, once that they had eliminated those things, it became a problem for the Burton machine, because then they had nothing else to campaign on. You know what I mean? So they twisted it, and they started campaigning. And Willie Brown was there. Willie Brown is another one that was really instrumental in the whole rise of the Burton machine. He was like Phil Burton's right-hand man. Willie Brown was a state. He termed out as the Speaker of the House in the California State Assembly, and then went on to serve 2 terms as mayor of San Francisco. And but they started campaigning and politically organizing more upon the threat of systemic racism and the notion of systemic racism than anything else. They were just like menacing the public with this. Oh, they're racist, you know, without any real basis in fact of this. And as most people know, San Francisco is probably the least racist place on the face of the planet. So, you know, it's strange that this thing would originate here, but they were campaigning on this. They continued to campaign on it, even though it had been eradicated. I mean, I challenge the audience to find a racist law on the books today in San Francisco, in California, or at the federal level. You know, there may be some racist things on the books in other states, maybe in the South and stuff like that. I don't know. I can't answer for that. What I've studied is San Francisco and California. But campaign on these things, they did. And so it became this kind of like thing that feeds upon itself, just as the government feeds upon itself. And you know, once a political machine gains power, that machine and the government that it lives in does things to make itself bigger and more powerful. And they played this identity-based politics thing to the hilt. And, you know, what they were doing is they're playing on people's fear. They're playing on people's hate. And the other thing that they were campaigning upon, besides the threat of systemic racism, was another thing that made people angry, which was redevelopment. And I go about that in the book. There was I call it the original sin. In the late 1950s, the first big redevelopment project in San Francisco was in the Fillmore District, which was the black district. And it was redevelopment is when it has to do with land use. Okay, if you have open land and you want to build something on it, then you call it land use. But if you have something, an area that's already built up and you have to either tear down or remodel structures in order to build new ones, then you call it redevelopment. It's not just development of the land, you're redeveloping the land. And there was this agency called the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency, and it was backed up by the feds. It had big money. It was backed up by something called the Bay Area Council, which to this day is just the most powerful group in the Bay Area that pretty much everybody doesn't know about, that I had to do lots of research to try to figure out who they were. This Bay Area Council and the feds and all the corporations behind it, they totally ganged up on the public in the late 1950s and then on into the 60s and 70s and all this. There's been all kinds of different redevelopment projects that have gone on in San Francisco over the decades. But the original one that really pissed people off was in the Fillmore District. It was and that had to do with the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency when it was around. And what they did was generally they just railroaded people out of town. There's a lot of details to it, and those details are covered in a book called City for Sale by Chester Hartman, if you want to look into that. But I don't get into the weeds too much in this book. I wanted to give more of an overview. And generally what happened was, yeah, they railroaded people out of San Francisco, like tens of thousands of people, so that they could knock down the buildings that they were living in and the businesses that they were inhabiting. And so they could build new structures. And they built this thing called Japantown. And they widened Geary Boulevard and did a bunch of other things. But the people who were living in the Fillmore District, they didn't like that. So, you know, that those were the two things that the Burton machine really, really cut their teeth on: the anger over redevelopment and the threat of systemic racism. Of course, earlier on, it was actual systemic racism, but then it very quickly evolved into just the threat of it. And so this is what they built. And there was Willie Brown. And he did the same thing. There were other politicians like Mervyn Dimely that history has forgotten. There was George Moscone, who was part of the Burton machine. And we're going to get into Jim Jones in just a second here. But it needs to be noted that, okay, Phil Burton died relatively young because he was like a wild man. He drank like a fish and smoked like a chimney, and he died of a ruptured abdominal artery in 1983. And his wife ran for his seat after he died, Sala Burton, and she won. But then she died, too, just a few years later after Phil. And on her deathbed, she requested that Nancy Pelosi, who was already head of the California Democrat Party, take over the Phil Burton machine and run for Phil Burton's old seat, or Sala's old seat at that point. And she did, and she won. And ever since then, Nancy Pelosi has been in the seat that Phil Burton held at the time that he died. And so, you know, the way it worked was that Phil Burton was an ideologue. He died basically broke. So he wasn't in it for the money. He was in it for the power. He loved power. And he was not a nice man. He was nasty. I mean, he would physically assault people, and he was just possessed with you know, all these ideas about systemic racism. I don't even think he really cared about systemic racism so much as just wielding power, wielding raw power. You know, it was just a tool. So San Francisco has served as an example for how to accumulate power and wield it. You know, of course, it all goes back to the civil rights movement and stuff of the early 1950s and that was kind of the original inspiration for all of this. And you know, similar stories have probably played out in many American cities. But I find the story of the how it happened in San Francisco quite interesting, because not only for the Phil Burton thing and Nancy Pelosi and Willie Brown and all that, but how Jim Jones plays into all of this. Now, would you like to comment, James, as to what you know about Jim Jones and his politics in San Francisco?
Well, you're doing such a terrific job, Peter, and know vastly more than I in the details here. Please do continue and share all that. Jim Jones, Jonestown, drinking the Kool-Aid. What a story.
Yeah, drinking the Kool-Aid is a very apt phrase here, because that's what people have been doing. That's what Democrats have been doing ever since, because what they're pushing has no basis in fact, no basis in reality. It's all just based upon people's anger and fear. And, you know, Jim, let me be very frank with you. It all preys upon the fact that we are living in a world that's dominated by Satan, you know, and so people are frustrated by this. And there's, you know, manifestations of this, and, you know, such as racism and such as big business crushing people's dreams and things like that. So, you know, when you start hitting on those hot button issues, people react and they get motivated and they vote for the candidate that's pushing those buttons. You know what I mean? So let's get into Jim Jones. Yeah, the Burton machine was more than happy to welcome Jim Jones into the fold when he started coming to San Francisco in, what was it, the late 60s? Yeah, the late 60s. It was, he was operating up in Redwood Valley, California, which is to the north up up near Ukiah. And that was the big original stronghold of the People's Temple in California. But from there, they got a fleet of buses, and they started going all over California and all over the country, actually, but mostly in California. They ended up getting a place down in Los Angeles as well, and probably other places up and down California. But their first big stronghold was in Redwood Valley, and they started coming down to San Francisco. Originally, they would kind of like rent places and be allowed to you know, hold sermons at different places, but they eventually established a place on Geary Boulevard between Fillmore and Steiner. If people are familiar with that, there's a post office there today. Now, it was a synagogue, oddly enough, an abandoned synagogue right next to the Fillmore Theater. You know, the famous Fillmore Theater, where all the 60s acts were. And Jones was appealing to the ethnic poor. And he was doing the same thing. He was saying that, like, you know, everything is racist. You've been victimized. You know, the black man is, you know, in dire straits and needs to be brought up and all this kind of stuff. And, he was very successful with this, and of course he was a total fraud. You know, he would hold like fake healings and stuff, where he would do things like have chicken guts in a plastic bag, and someone would go into the bathroom and come out and produce this bag with chicken guts in it, and say that, you know, this was his cancer that he had just vomited out due to the preaching of Jim Jones and all this. And he was a pharmaceutical junkie since the late 1950s. He was, but he was, you know, he was organizing politically. This is why the Burton machine liked him. It was just like he would evangelize for his church. He could easily transition into evangelizing for whatever politician the Burton machine wanted him to evangelize for. And he was quite effective at it. He would offer on demand political organizing. He would offer on demand voters. And in the 1975 mayoral election, he provided on demand voter fraud. And this was the pivotal moment in the history of San Francisco. It was the 1975 mayoral election that really solidified the power of the Burton machine in San Francisco. As I mentioned, Phil Burton really started operating at the state level, even though he was, you know, out of a California State Assembly seat representing San Francisco, but still he was in the state house. So he had power over San Francisco, but in a way it was limited to his actions in the state house. He didn't really have that grassroots, organic, boots on the ground in San Francisco power until Jim Jones and the People's Temple stole the 1975 mayoral election for him in favor of George Moscone. It was not only George Moscone that they swept into office. There was also a progressive Burton Machine district attorney, as well as a sheriff. And the way they did it was they had it was just through voter fraud, you know, stuff that we've been found out about recently, you know, in the 2020 election. Well, is the, you know, of course, they've kicked it up to a whole new level. But, you know, there's voter fraud and election fraud. Election fraud, just so people know, election fraud is when behind the scenes, sort of executively, people just flip an entire election. But the voter fraud is when you're actually, like, you know, there's individual fraudulent ballots and individual fraudulent voters and lots of them. And there's enough of that to sway the election for you. So Jim Jones would have, he had people living in this temple that they had, the permanent facilities of San Francisco they had on Geary Boulevard between Fillmore and Steiner, the old synagogue next to the Fillmore Theater. And there were, if you were a member of the temple, they would register all kinds of people to vote at your address. If you lived in San Francisco and you were a member of the temple, they would just register like all kinds of people. You wouldn't even know about it. They would just go ahead and do it. And you have like scores of people registered to vote at your address. And this is how they pulled all this off. And they would drive around people in buses to all the different polling places. And they would vote multiple times in all these different locations all throughout San Francisco. And, you know, this was admitted to by Jim Jones Jr. It was admitted to later by People's Temple members in a New York Times article. And the district attorney of San Francisco, Ken Harrington, publicly stated that he thinks that they stole the election. And there's other evidence as well. It's kind of slipping my mind now. It's all in the book. But so anyway, but they got it. And the guy that got beat out of it, he was a supervisor by the name of John Barbagelata. He was a real estate mogul in San Francisco, and that company exists to this day. It's called Barbagelata Real Estate, or Barbco. And John Barbagelata, he was a good guy. This has been a great revelation for me. There are actually good guys in this story, and the guy who got cheated out of the 1975 mayoral election in a runoff against George Moscone, John Barbagelata, he was saying that as well. He's saying, hey, you know, there's lots of problems here, and he's saying they stole it, and but they stole it, and then there was an investigation right after Moscone came into office. But the guy who was at the top of overseeing the entire investigation was the district attorney who had just been swept into office and was a Burton Machine guy, this Joseph Freitas. And Freitas, in order to conduct, he brought in someone to conduct the investigation itself. Guess who he brought in? He brought in the top legal advisor to Jim Jones, a guy by the name of Tim Stone, to oversee the investigation. And then People's Temple members came in to help with the clerical work on the investigation. So it was no surprise when the investigation, you know, the results of the investigation came out and they found no wrongdoing. So, you know, from that point, it was, you know, just Burton Machine politicians going to the People's Temple and singing, chanting socialist songs and, you know, praising Jim Jones and all of this. And this, and Jones eventually was made chairman of the San Francisco Housing Commission. Moscone pulled some strings to get him in there. Moscone originally offered him a position on the Human Rights Commission, but Jones thought that was beneath him. And he held out for a position on the Housing Commission. And once he got on the Housing Commission, Moscone pulled some strings and made him chairman. So, but then years later, these these stories and the evidence of the election having been stolen persisted. And at about 3 years later, state and federal investigators finally got involved and started asking questions. And one of the first things they did was go to the records, the Hall of Records, where they keep the records from the 1975 election, and they found that the records were missing. The records didn't exist anymore. So that was the end of that. And, you know, see, but what I call the legacy of Jim Jones is quite fascinating because, you know, we know that, okay, he had to flee to Jonestown not long. It was about maybe just a couple years after the stolen. Yeah, it was 1978. So 3 years after the stolen 1975 election, he fled to Jonestown because there was stories in the press popping up that was that were exposing all the nasty stuff that he was doing. He was beating people. He was stealing people's money. He was torturing people. I mean, it was really bad. And I think he got tipped off about how local authorities were about to come and arrest him, basically, or run some kind of raid or something. And I think he was tipped off and he left to Guyana. He was scoping out the Guyana location for many years as an escape hatch. And he used that escape hatch just before he was going to be arrested or something like that. And so they fled to Jonestown, and there was like, you know, about 900 or a little over 900 members. They all ended up committing suicide, and there's a, you know, whole story there. There was Congressman Leo Ryan going down there, the Ryan mission, some reporters, and Jackie Speier is still around today. She survived it somehow. Congressman Leo Ryan did not survive. There was a big map, but there were like over 900 People's Temple members that drank the Kool-Aid. And Jim Jones ended up with a bullet in his head. It's sort of unclear as to how that bullet got there.
Peter?
Yeah.
Peter, hold that thought. We'll be right back. This is wonderful stuff. Right back to the interview.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war
is coming. And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Peter, this is completely fascinating. Your knowledge is so vast and detailed. One of our listeners has written to ask if there's a Jewish connection between those who took over San Francisco politics, the Burtons and Pelosi and so forth, some link to, you know, the Israeli lobby or whatever. Would you care to comment?
I haven't found one.
Okay.
I characterize Jewish people as one of the most powerful gangs. The other one I would characterize as the Masons. So, you know, there's different gangs out there that are very powerful and doing a lot of different things. I wouldn't put everything all at the feet of the Jews. They're just one of the more powerful gangs. But yeah, I haven't found any connections yet, except for the fact that the People's Temple permanent headquarters was this synagogue on Geary Boulevard between Fillmore and Steiner. And this was also that former synagogue also served as a rehearsal hall for a lot of the 60s bands, a lot of the 60s acid rock bands like Jefferson Airplane and some others. I'm actually looked into the 60s thing. I plan to, in the future, I plan to put out a book called The Hippies, brought to you by the CIA. And get into how I think the CIA fabricated the whole flower power movement of the late 1960s, and I plan to deliver the evidence.
Oh, Peter, that's wonderful. Do continue.
Okay, so yeah, we left off with Jim Jones getting a bullet in his head. And all that happened because there were these continuing questions about, you know, what the People's Temple was doing, and that's why the Ryan mission went down there. There was all kinds of loose ends of, people were asking all kinds of questions and wanted answers, and Jim Jones had potentially violated all kinds of laws and things. So, you know, American law was still interested in what was going on down there, and that caused everybody to have their mass suicide down there drinking the Kool-Aid. And but there were, even after all that, there were still a lot of People's Temple members living in California, and specifically in San Francisco. There were 300, Spartan soldiers, right? 300 remaining in San Francisco, still alive at the time of the Jonestown Massacre. And some of them, not long after the Jonestown Massacre, they were having breakfast with Dianne Feinstein. She was inquiring as to their well-being. So
you're kidding me.
I'm not kidding. Willie Brown initially sided with Jim Jones. After the news of the massacre came in for, I think, at least months, Willie Brown's like, I have no regrets. I'm so happy that, you know, I worked with Jim Jones. Willie Brown was running. Willie Brown had previously taken over the local NAACP. It was being run out of a church called Jones Methodist, and he fostered a radical faction of the NAACP that eventually vanquished the conservative faction of the NAACP at Jones Methodist Church in San Francisco. And Willie Brown eventually ran the NAACP out of his law offices with his partner John Dearman. And on the board of directors local branch of the NAACP run out of Willie Brown's law offices was Jim Jones and two other members of the People's Temple. So, yeah, Willie Brown remained loyal to Jim Jones even after the massacre. Dianne Feinstein was having breakfast with some of them, inquiring as to their well-being. Before Jim Jones died, he had stuffed all kinds of People's Temple members into public housing and into the San Francisco Housing Commission, and I would assume into other areas of San Francisco government. So it looks to me like the legacy of Jim Jones has been the motivating factor behind San Francisco government in the years following the Jonestown massacre. So I call it the Jim Jones effect, the legacy of Jim Jones. The People's Temple has had a continuing influence upon the city of San Francisco, as far as I can tell. And, you know, as we know, the government of the city of San Francisco sure acts like it's being run by a bunch of cult members. So this makes nothing but sense. And yeah.
Tell us, Peter, about how did it come about the vast homelessness, drug addicts, San Francisco becoming the feces capital of the universe, or map showing the quantity of human feces distributed through San Francisco that boggled the mind. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I attribute this mostly to a public that doesn't understand what they're doing. They think that continuing to fund homelessness is going to solve the problem somehow. And, you know, as recently as I think it was 2008, they voted for a new tax that is to fund homelessness. And, you know, all these politicians have been saying and bureaucrats have been promoting this as well. Over the years that, you know, we're going to solve the problem. We just need more money. And so, you know, year after year, decade after decade, the amount of money that's being spent on homelessness in the city of San Francisco has been astronomical. It peaked, I think it was in 2019, at about, I think it was $815 million. Just, you know, spending on like shelters and food and clothing and services and stuff. And all of this, now we're going to get into political philosophy. You see, this is all due to a misguided political philosophy. People think that the way you solve the problem is to throw more money at it. They think that if they vote for politicians that say that they're going to do something and make the problem better is going to solve it. In fact, what you should be doing is the opposite. You should be defunding this. At least the government should not be paying for it. Government paying for goods and services and housing people and all this stuff is simply beyond the scope of government. It's beyond the scope of what government should be doing. These things should be, you know, in the case that these things are even a thing in society that need to be rectified, the money that's used to help people who are down on their luck and stuff should not be provided by government. It should be provided by the private sector. When people are helped out by the private sector. You know, in many cases, it's the church. The money is much more rationally given out. It's not this thing where, like, you know, like it's a big phenomenon that feeds upon itself and becomes like a political football, and becomes something that politicians can campaign on and things like that. If these problems are addressed by the private sector, then it's done in a much more rational fashion without all the politics. When you start inserting politics into these things, then stuff goes off the rails real quickly. And there's a certain chapter in the book I call a Requiem for the Burton Machine, where I expound upon the political philosophy of basically, I'm basically preaching republicanism, although I don't call it that. And throughout the vast majority of the book, I probably mention the word Republican twice and the word Democrat once or twice. I just say, like, you know, there's political opposition. I don't say, like, liberal or conservative. I'm just trying to make it as apolitical as possible. But I understand that what I'm preaching is basically republicanism, that you want a limited government, a government that's as small as possible. Government should, in my opinion, although I think most people out there will agree with me. Yes, Jim.
Really, you mean only as large as necessary? You don't mean it quite literally as small as possible, except that it must be able to conduct a function, the proper functions of government. Yeah. So you want a kind of a lean and elegant government that is not excessive in any direction or weighted one way or another. I mean, I think what you're doing is not espousing republicanism so much as simply good government.
Okay. You could call it that. But I think the only thing that government should ever fund is the military, infrastructure, and the judicial system. And then just a little bit of money for the bureaucrats, in other words, the politicians. You know, politicians that double as bureaucrats. They can pay for their own staff, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, just administrative, minimal administrative things. It's not the government's job to house people. It's not the government's job to provide goods and services. It's not the government's job to intervene in all situations. You know, and see, this is the wrong-headed political philosophy that abounds in San Francisco. I know, because I used to think like this. People, probably about 85-90% of the population, maybe more, whenever there's a problem, they think immediately the answer to the problem is government. Petitioning of government, the government should do this, the government should do that, the government should do the other thing. When in actuality, in a prosperous society where people have enough wealth and enough free time to do these things, they go and do it themselves. You see, society takes care of itself. This is the way it's supposed to be. Excuse me. I have a good example in the book. It just so happened that when I was getting close to finishing the book, and I was on the last chapter where I talk about political philosophies. Excuse me.
Sure, take your time.
I saw this news story. I just happened to see this news story where they were talking about how maybe 200 people from the Mission District gathered together and they marched down Valencia Street, maybe a mile or two to City Hall, where they were having a Board of Supervisors meeting. And they were walking down there carrying signs and chanting slogans and all this. And what they went down to City Hall, they started talking to the Board of Supervisors. One after one, they would come to the mic and basically tell the same story. What they were doing this for was they were talking about how they needed help with their rent. They thought it was the government's job to help them with their rent. They're like, you got to do something about the rent, man. It's too high. Like, I might have to move out and stuff. It's like, okay, you know, welcome to the free market. You actually think it's the government's job to help you reside in San Francisco? I mean, you know, if people could just look at this rationally and you know, take out all the emotion and all the, you know, freaking out and all this kind of stuff. I mean, really? You really think that? You know, government in San Francisco, they're always pushing this idea, like one of their bureaucrats and politicians, one of their favorite things to say is that health care is a human right. They say housing is a human right. And, you know, with that line of reasoning, you can go on down the line and say food is a human right. Transportation is a human right. Okay, well, you know, that's an interesting intellectual discussion that maybe you and I could have, Jim. But when that type of rhetoric is coming from government, what they're making an argument for is communism, right? They're making an argument for government providing people with everything that they need in their life. And so that's communism. And they never seem to learn. You know, how many times do we need to see communist dictatorships where hundreds of millions of people suffer and are executed under this? You know, what we need is free trade. What we need is the market to function properly, the government in the background. That creates a prosperous society where everybody's needs are met. Without the ubiquitous bloat and corruption of government constantly meddling in the free market. You know, I used to actually think this, Jim. It was maybe only a couple years ago before I really did the research for this book. I kind of held out the idea that, like, well, you know, maybe the ultimate society is some such type of thing where, you know, the government is at the, like, a hub of all life, and, you know, and everything is distributed by the government and it controls all this. But that's like when I was talking to Ginny Silcox, you know, Ginny, on the phone the other night, and she said, yeah, that's childish. It's a childish notion to believe that government is going to be there acting as your mother and father and providing you with everything. You know, in the book, I write how these protesters who marched down to City Hall asking the Board of Supervisors to help them with their rent, they were just like little babies crying to mommy and daddy to have their diaper changed. You know, help me out. Oh, you guys you're all powerful. Oh, all powerful government, please help us. We need things, you know. And,
you know, I think you're right, Peter, that there is an attitude of carrying over the idea of government as somehow a parental relationship to the citizens. And a lot of these views, I do think it is certainly a form of all-embracing government that has many characteristics of communism. I think you're correct, especially when you throw into the mix the incompetence of government in general to carry out its assigned responsibilities. I mean, this, we lead to the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, it's by virtue of competition among private enterprises to accomplish tasks as a form of capitalism qualified by basic human rights that make America function as well as it has in the past and may explain why we're on the verge of collapse today ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is why I think part of one of the things that government should be doing is the judicial system, you know, because the argument against the free market that a lot of these communists wage is that, well, look, you know, these corporations, they're out of control. They're doing all this. They're doing all that. Well, if you have a properly functioning judicial system, then complaints are lodged, lawsuits are waged, and then corporations are forced to stop doing what they're doing if it's malfeasance, if they're doing something wrong. You know, and then, of course, you get into how maybe our judicial system is not functioning properly. Well, then maybe our focus should be on creating a properly functioning judicial system more than anything else.
Yes. But, yes, good stuff. Continue. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So there's more in the book. You know, the philosophy is the second to last chapter, the chapter I call Requiem for the Burden Machine, and the Jim Jones stuff is kind of in the middle. I guess another thing I'd like to get into is this Bay Area Council. That's what comes to mind. People don't even know about this, but there was this group. It was a combination of corporate and government powers that started during World War II, ostensibly to smooth over government function during World War II because of the ongoing war effort. You know, the government was and corporations were stretched in their capacity to do things. So they formed this, it was called the MDC, wasn't it? Military Defense Council, or something like that, I think. I think that was the original name of it. But it was a bunch of corporations like Southern Pacific, and they're slipping my mind right now, but there was about five or six big corporations that were mainly operating in the West, big corporations at the time that were big deals in the West that combined with local governments to do these things, like providing or overseeing at least fire protection services, police services, distribution of goods and things like that. And but then they had some issues. There was some squabbling about how all this should be done, and it was eventually dissolved. But this was the predecessor organization to the Bay Area Council, which was formed just after World War II, and they started bringing in more corporations and started solidifying more relationships with local government. So there, people don't know about this, but that is basically the Bay Area Council. Ever since the end of World War II, has basically been the group that all of these politicians and bureaucrats answer to. They are the overseer of everything that's happened, and they've been the group that has been pushing Agenda 21, of course, over the San Francisco Bay region, and they've created a whole bunch of different proxy organizations, sort of surrogate organizations that people may be more familiar with. There's something called they came up with something called the Association of Bay Area Governments. Now, see, to me, when I first learned about the Association of Bay Area Governments, I thought that was the most secret group. I didn't know there was another group behind them. But this Association of Bay Area Governments is a bunch of politicians that meet together to address regional issues. And it was formed by a joint powers agreement in 1961. Between a bunch of different Bay Area counties, all the counties of the Bay Area. And it's funny because they present themselves as government, and they have the force of government, and yet they are not government. They were formed with a joint powers agreement. They weren't formed by statute. And yet, throughout the decades, they've been pushing Agenda 21, and they have spawned a group, another one of the Bay Area Council's proxies, called the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. Now this group is government. It was created by the Bay Area Council and ABAG, the Association of Bay Area Governments. But the MTC was created by statute. You see how convoluted all of this is? You know, they make it so. I like that quote from Bob Marley.
Gregory, let me call you at the break in just a few. Continue. Yeah, continue, Peter.
Yeah, he says, Bob Marley said, they build their world in great confusion to force on us the devil's illusion. You know?
Yeah.
And so you can never, unless you really dig in and read all these books and read these documents. You never really understand who the rulers are. I mean, they're all hidden. You know, I think that's one of the great things about the book is that it reveals to you who these people are that are running all these things. You know, because you see things happening in the city of San Francisco, they're making bike lanes, they're closing off streets. If you didn't know about this, they call it slow streets. they do all kinds of different things with transportation, and that's what the Metropolitan Transportation Commission is all about. And I think most people never really even think, like, you know, where is this coming from? It just kind of happens. But even if you ask yourself, where is this coming from? Well, then you're presented with this whole, you know, series of questions and roadblocks as to the actual fact behind all of this. But yeah, the Bay Area Council, through their surrogate operations, they've been pushing the Agenda 21. And to this day, the Association of Bay Area Governments there's been a whole bunch of laws passed that, of course, originate from the Bay Area Council that have been mandating what they call low-cost housing, what I call housing project construction. They basically want to build ghettos. That's what one of the main tenets of Agenda 21 is. They just want to build just ghettos all along the freeways where people live in tiny little boxes. They're all controlled by, like, electromagnetic energy, and, you know, that they make next to nothing, and they worship the government and depend on everything to, you know, they call it the 15-minute cities now. They have all kinds of different names for it and stuff. But, you know, they call it low-cost housing. That sounds so nice. I mean, you know, we haven't learned this, that you build housing projects and, you know, it's really not a very nice place to live. But they're trying to do that writ large now with all kinds of laws that have been passed at the state level. And it's ABAG's job, the Association of Bay Area Governments, to force compliance among localities with all these low-cost housing mandates. I mean, they're trying to turn San Francisco, California, and the entire nation into just a ghetto of just dumbed down vaccine head people that have no ability to fight or understand what's going on here, and, you know, just perpetually assaulted with electromagnetic energy and chemtrails and GMOs in the food, and, you know, just this onslaught of chemicals everywhere. I mean, this is why I think a lot of people have these wrong-headed political philosophies, is that they can't think straight. You know, you and I were fortunate enough to be born at a time when, yeah, there were chemicals in the environment, and yeah, maybe we got a few shots, but I mean, kids today, they get like 60 shots by the time they're 12 years old, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, and not only that, they're eating the GMOs, you know, all the chemical fertilizers and pesticides, they're sucking in the chemtrails, they got fluoride in the water. I mean, these people cannot think straight.
Yeah,
they're assaulted by the mainstream media that puts all this nonsense into their heads and makes them believe that government is their mommy and daddy and is going to solve all their problems. And they're like, yeah, I need somebody to solve my problems because, you know, I got a lot of them. I can't even wet my own butt, you know. And so, you know, this is why people have these wrong-headed political beliefs and go seek some type of authority to just help them out, because they've been so dumbed down and so assaulted in so many different ways that they literally cannot help themselves.
You know? Peter, we're gonna be hitting a break momentarily, and I'm gonna open the lines for calls. Which is 608-957-8727. 608-957-8727 to speak with Peter Kirby and me about these issues. Peter, you've just done a sensational job. Where can your book be obtained?
Yes, The Fall of San Francisco, now available on Amazon.com exclusively.
Very, very nice. So you publish it through the Amazon service. What do they call it now? My first book on Sandy Hook was then called CreateSpace.
Yeah, CreateSpace was acquired by Amazon at some point. I think I'm not even sure if they use that word CreateSpace anymore. But yeah, I know, Jim, though, they took your book down and everything, right? That's terrible. And, you know, I really appreciate everything that you do, Jim. You know, all the stuff that you've had to face is just amazing to me. I mean, if people even understood, like, you know, the struggles that you've had to face in this information war, you're truly one of the great warriors in this fight. And, you know, I want to read all of your books. My problem is that I'm, you know, I keep on getting into the things that I need to read for my next book. But, you know, I want to read all of them, and I appreciate you very much.
Those are very kind words, Peter. Yeah, sometimes I feel that those who write books and those who read them, it's very tough to do both. I do a huge amount of information processing with all these shows I'm doing, so I'm constantly reviewing the latest news, but that doesn't afford a lot of opportunities for reading books. And it's odd, but it looks as though the server here at Revolution Radio hasn't responded with a final break, so we can go forward and continue. Peter, you're just a wealth of knowledge, and California, of course, has meant so much to me. I find it utterly fascinating to have someone with so many insights and so much experience expounding on what the hell has happened, because there was a time when it was far and away the greatest place to live, I think, even in the world, and most certainly not the case today. In fact, people are leaving California at a higher rate than they're coming in, which is the first time in the nation's history that's been true. Further, just continue, Peter. We'll see if anyone calls or not. Often, when they're so absorbed by what a guest is saying, they do not call in because they want to hear everything he has to say. You are such a guest.
Well, thanks again, Jim. And what pops into my mind is the illegal immigration. You know, I get into that into the books. San Francisco was made a sanctuary city in 1989. That's where local law enforcement does not cooperate with the feds in routine matters of immigration. And the whole state of California was made a sanctuary state in 2017. I attribute that to a temper tantrum, you know, against Trump. They're like, oh, well, you're going to do that. Oh, we're going to make the whole state a sanctuary state. Yeah, yeah, yeah. How do you like us now? You know, I think that was kind of the attitude compelling that that particular legislation. But the root of all of our socioeconomic problems, not limited to San Francisco, of course, is illegal immigration. That's why we have so many homeless people on the street. You know what I mean? Because the illegal immigrants are coming in and underbidding everybody out of these jobs. And, you know, these are Americans who say, like, I'm not going to work for your slave wages. You know, I'm not going to be living like illegal immigrants, like, you know, 10 people living in a one-bedroom apartment and things like that. And, you know, and it's just not what I do. I'd rather just, you know, live on the street and collect stuff from the government. You know, this is basically what has happened here. And then also, I think a lot of the crime, and, you know, most of it has been committed by black people. I don't like to specify race, and I don't in the book too much, and just in general in life. But, I have to admit that we've basically been under a black crime wave, and I attribute that to illegal immigration. Because a lot of black people have, you know, traditionally held a lot of the unskilled positions, and the illegal immigrants are coming in and just taking all of that away. They're just soaking up all of the opportunity. A good example is one of these stories in the news lately about Tyson Foods, you know, getting rid of the American citizens and taking on all kinds of illegal aliens because they're working for less. In San Francisco, the Bayview District is the biggest stronghold of African Americans or black people in San Francisco. And that district used to be known as Butchertown because that's where all the meat processing plants were. That the meat processing, I gather, not only in San Francisco, but nationwide, a lot of black people have worked in meat processing plants. And now all the illegals are coming in and taking all those jobs. And you know, so young black people, that they see all this happening, and they're like, you know, what are you talking about? There's no opportunity here. I'm just going to go steal stuff. You know, I'm just going to F you. I'm going to go like smash your windows and start robbing people because, you know, there's no opportunity. So I think those are a couple things that a lot of people haven't fully realized the effects here of all this illegal immigration. And so, you know, they talk about pertaining to San Francisco, they're like, oh, there's a housing crisis. And housing was very tight during the tech boom and the years following. But a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were encouraging all kinds of illegal aliens to come to San Francisco ever since 1989. The tech boom had started in the mid-90s, and we've been a sanctuary city since 1989. So it's not a complicated equation. I mean, they're coming in and, you know, taking up a lot of the places. If you're living, you know, four or five people in a studio apartment, 10 people in a one bedroom, it's pretty easy to outbid other people who want to live, you know, like two people to a one bedroom, or, you know, one person in a studio and things like that. You know, it's actually quite simple if you think about these things. And so, yeah, I mean, we're being invaded, Jim. I think that time will tell. That I think that there is going to be a military-style takeover attempted here in this country, with all kinds of forces coming from all over the world up through the southern border. I think that there is going to be some kind of organized military takeover. I think it's going to be squashed. And I think that's going to be the last thing that America needs to do to find a golden age.
Well, I'm concerned there's going to be. I mean, it looks to me like we have not just an invasion of illegals, we have an invasion of an army that's going to be used against us. And I think your point about the illegals undermining the economy and putting people out on the street is impeccable. I think that's exactly right. And, you know, you look at, I was enumerating that list of benefits you got in New York City. I mean, who wouldn't want this free ride, free food, free lodging, free medicine, free transportation, fly anywhere you want, all for free on the back of the government? Well, who the hell's paying for that, Peter? You and I, the American taxpayers, are paying for that. It's as outrageous as it gets. Completely disgusting.
Yeah. It's absolutely shocking what's going on, that any of these politicians could rationalize any of this stuff. But they do, Jim. They do. It's just insane to me. You know, you see these progressive Democrats, they support this stuff. They actually support this stuff. It's just, it's unbelievable. It's unfathomable what's going on. I mean, not all of them, but, you know, to even be an American citizen and just encourage this type of stuff, I mean, it's just a complete lack of common sense, a complete lack of self-respect. And, you know, when people come into our country illegally, they immediately disrespect our laws and our country as a sovereign nation. And to encourage such things is just incredible.
Well, of course, they're criminals coming in. I mean, that's how they got here, by violating our laws. Of course, they have no respect whatsoever, Peter. You are 100% correct again. Well, just outrageous. Outrageous.
We should be trying to get their best and brightest. You know? Yes. You know, if we want to have a highly functioning society, a highly prosperous society, well, then we need to create ourselves as such. We need to be that thing that people aspire to. You know, if you want to bring the whole world up and move forward into a golden age and into a prosperous world, then you have to create a situation where people strive to attain these goals. We as a society in America need to do that. I call it a meritocracy, where people work hard and are rewarded and compensated for their work. And then also you apply that to second and third world countries, where they, in their countries, they need to learn English, first of all, and then learn some kind of skill that's going to be desired here in America. And then, yes, please come in. You know, please come in if you have something that you have to offer other than non-skilled labor. Because when people just flood in and just take all the unskilled positions, Well, then, you know, there's actually a lot of people in America that would like to have those positions, the unskilled positions, notably kids working their way through college. I mean, you know, Jim, in years past, we saw this many times, highly successful people who worked their way through college. They were able to have a part-time job at a restaurant, working as a cook or a waiter or something like that, or maybe even driving a cab or this and that. And, you know, it provided the opportunity for them to rise higher on the ladder because of these things. And those opportunities aren't available because all those jobs are being taken. It's most repugnant when it happens to United States, former United States military members who come out of the service and they don't have skills that are desired in the civilian workforce. They would get to, take up a unskilled position. But then those aren't available. Or if they are available, they're only available for like slave wages. And you know, the people who come out of the military, they're like, I just served my country. You know, you're offering me this. This is nothing. This is garbage what you're offering me, you know. And then they live on the street and they start using drugs and stuff. And it's all bad news from there. You know, and yes. It's just absolutely horrible how all this is happening. And you get, you know, so you ask yourself, like, why is this happening? And like, why are these politicians and bureaucrats so adamant about this? Well, it's because, and so this is why I think that, yes, they are organizing to finally go after America in some type of military style takeover, because, you know, that this, because I think it's obviously a hatred of this country. There's obviously evil intentions behind this, because this is not constructive. This is destructive. You know, this is society falling apart before your eyes. And I've seen many people. I mean, if you've been around long enough, you've seen beauty. You've seen wonderful things happen in America where you just stand in awe of it. And, you know, you're just like, wow, that was really cool what these people put together. And this is not it. This is not that. It's just on its face. It's evil on its face. It's bad on its face. It's just something really nasty is brewing here.
Oh, I agree completely. Barack Obama told us at one point that he wanted to fundamentally transform America. I'm sorry to say, I think this is exactly what he had in mind. Have you ever pondered this particular peculiar phenomenon in American politics? I mean, it's not just that he's gay, that he's married to a man who poses as a woman. That isn't even the ultimate issue with Obama. He appears to be a creature of the CIA and to be undertaking, you know, he appears to be pulling a string behind Biden. I've proven others too, again and again, that the guy who's posing as a president is some actor wearing a mask even. He has a different shape and size of skull. He has different color eyes. He has different signature. It's not Joe Biden or his granddaughter, as even has said. The real Joe died in 2017. But the family wanted to keep their hand in politics. And, they've been using, she said he had a twin brother, but I do not know that to be the case. In any case, it's very odd because he seemed to have the same kind of cognitive decline we'd expect. I went back to old videos of the real Joe. And Peter, he was very articulate. He was very expressive. He used his hands and gestures a lot, as do I myself. Totally different in manner, style than the present guy. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree completely. I actually subscribe to the theory that Joe Biden, the original Joe Biden, is not with us anymore. And
yes.
He's been dealt with at Gitmo or some other military installation, and what we have now is just some kind of facsimile of Joe Biden. And Obama is, of course, a complete fraud. I mean, something that people have kind of forgotten about, his birth certificate, just absolute complete fraud. I mean, it was a PDF that was released, and, you know, Joe Arpaio and his lead investigator on the case, it totally exposed how you can prove that the document is just a complete fraud, like 10 different ways. It was all buried by the press. I mean, we have no idea who this guy is. You know,
I agree. We have no idea who this guy is. I mean, it's just stunning.
They didn't even want to run Joe Biden. Their plan was to run Hillary Clinton for 2 years. You know, that was the plan. Trump kind of upset that. Thank God he won in 2016. I mean, can you imagine what kind of situation we'd be under near the end of a second Hillary Clinton term right now?
Scary, scary, scary thought.
Oh, yeah.
Scary thought.
They'd be carting people off to those detention centers. And there would be open civil war in this country by this point, probably, if Hillary Clinton had been elected and able to steal it in 2016. Thank God she didn't. I don't even know how that really happened. But as far as the transformation of society stuff goes, I address this in the book. It's not the job of government to transform society. It's the job of the citizenry, you know. And it's not like America was so horrible to begin with. You know, they always harp upon this thing like, oh, the slavery, we had slavery in America. Yeah, the slavery was a condition of the time. You know, slavery was going on in Europe and all throughout the world when America was founded. But we're supposed to immediately not have slavery in America when America is founded. And I mean, how are we going to compete economically? How are you going to just do that? I mean, it was part of the culture at the time. The operative thing about America was that America led the way in abolishing slavery.
Yes.
That's the important thing about America, that, you know, just because the Bill of Rights and the Constitution was written on paper at the time that these things were ratified doesn't mean that they immediately go into effect. These are goals that we work towards. You know, and there's a whole process of working towards all this over time that takes decades and centuries to happen. And that has been fulfilled. America has been fulfilling the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. It just takes time. And then, you know, as I felt like, even though Bush was a horrible president, Bush Jr., I felt like at the time, you know, he was the predecessor to Obama. I felt like at the time, racism was kind of fading away.
Yeah.
I consciously felt that and realized it. And I was like, oh, this is a good thing. And then as soon as Obama comes in, it's like he just keeps on playing the race card and just playing it up and like talking about all this racism and racism, just beating people over the head with it. And he just inflamed all of it all of a sudden. I mean, just like what happened in San Francisco when the laws – the racist practices and laws were being done away with, these politicians came in and they didn't like that. They didn't like the fact that those things were being done away with. These are political organizing tools for them. They say, oh, no, hold on. There's all this racism here. There's all these problems. You know, you gotta vote for me and, you know, join our machine because we got to fight all this stuff. That fight's already been done.
Well, How racist can a country be when it elects a black man president, not just once, but twice, Peter? I mean, the whole idea of America as a nation, racist nation, is absurd.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the least, America is the least racist nation on the face of the earth. The least racist. You want to see racism, go to the Middle East. Go to, like, countries in Southeast Asia. You know, go to... pretty much any other country, well, probably about half of the other countries in the world are just outrageously racist against one group or the other. And then, you know, there's this concentration on America as somehow being all systemically racist and horrible and, you know, needs to be revolutionized and all this. It's just absurd.
Yes, completely absurd. I could not agree more. Well, seems to me you've done a super job with your book. Peter, I'm just very, very impressed. your breadth and depth of knowledge involving California, but also the larger picture of what's going on in America seems to me to be spot on. Or I'm just very, very
Professor impressed Fetzer,
by all you've had to say here today.
Professor Fetzer, last time I only got a B minus. What's my grade this time?
Oh, I got to give you an A. Maybe even close to an A plus, Peter. I mean, this is really very, very impressive in every direction. I love it. I love it.
Well, I hope the audience loved it too. Yeah, and so if you like what you're hearing here, you can read about The Fall of San Francisco. That's the title of my book, The Fall of San Francisco by Peter A. Kirby. It's available on Amazon. And my website is peteracurby.com. You can join my email list there.
Peter, that's super. The Fall of San Francisco at Amazon.com. And I'm pleased they've not banned your book. I mean, that's a good sign. I mean, even my own, you know, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook had been produced by Amazon itself, and yet they banned it.
That subject
less than a month after gone on sale, but that's because it just exposed too much truth. And it was, I believe, Amazon acting as an agent of the government. You know, they use that, these. Go ahead.
Yeah, that subject, James, in particular, that is their sacred cow. There's certain subjects that the establishment will choose that, you know, you can absolutely not question this. And you know, Sandy Hook is probably the number one issue like that. They chose that one as something that they were going to defend to the death. And, you know, chemtrails is sort of in there. And what I'm talking about in the Fall of San Francisco is sort of in there. But the Sandy Hook thing, you cannot speak the truth about Sandy Hook. Absolutely. They decided that. And you've been fighting them, Jim, and I really appreciate that.
I'm not done, Peter, but I tell you, I really like what you're doing with your book, The Fall of San Francisco, sorting these out. You're doing a brilliant job. My congratulations, Peter, and I'm so glad to have you on the show today. In fact, listen, give us a brief update on chemtrails. We got maybe four and a half, five minutes. Do it.
Well, the latest thing that I've been aware of is the state of Tennessee, maybe you heard about this, has passed a bill, apparently. I think it passed, if I'm not mistaken. I just was reading something about it. That basically bans chemtrails. It's Tennessee,
yeah.
the state legislature. So that's pretty big.
And, of course, it seems the Air Force is running the chemtrail program, from all I can tell. I mean, we have radar covering every cubic inch of space above the United States. If the United States Air Force obviously knows who's doing it, and the reason they're not going after trying to stop it is because they are the ones who are doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, the juiciest angle that I have right now, if I were to do another paper on chemtrails right now, I would do it on the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board. I talk about them in one of my videos on my Rumble channel. I have a show on Rumble called The Abstract, if you want to go there and check out what I have, and please follow me there, everybody. But I did one video called The Post-War Development of the New Manhattan Project, and in it I talk about this Air Force Scientific Advisory Board, and I think that that's the group, the military group, that has been most central to producing the New Manhattan Project. They're still around today. And to learn more about that, please watch that video, the post-war development of the New Manhattan Project. It's a video on my Rumble channel, The Abstract.
The Abstract.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds terrific, Peter. Absolutely wonderful.
I'm also on Truth Social. Truth Social, The Abstract.
Donald is just, it seems, selling Truth Social for some $3 billion. I don't know. Do you know the latest on that too, Peter?
Yeah, I heard about it. I think it was $5 billion, but there was some kind of like technical thing whereby the Truth Social company merged with what they call a SPAC, and this had been put aside and not done for some time, but it just happened like Friday. I think today is the first day that the shares are trading on the stock exchange, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, I'm very pleased with Truth Social. Are you on Truth Social, James?
No, actually, I'm not. I haven't considered doing that. Perhaps I should.
I trust Truth Social. I trust that they're not going to censor me. I don't think they'd censor you either, James. And I think that's going to be huge going forward.
Yeah, very, 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 very good, Peter. Very good. I'm glad you're taking advantage of it, even if at present, at least, I am not. Tell us more about your website again, Peter.
PeterAKirby.com. You'll find all my books there. You'll find links to my show, The Abstract. I did the Chemtrails book. I got The Fall of San Francisco that just came out. Before that, I did another book called From Little Acorns that I didn't publicize too much. It's a work of fiction, I'm just going to say. There's kind of a lot more behind that story, but I'm just going to call it a work of fiction. But if people are familiar with it, they know that there's more to the story. But I feel good just calling it a work of fiction. It's actually based in truth. But yeah, I got three books for sale now on Amazon, and I'm working on my next one. Is going to be something about electromagnetic mind control. I'm going to call remote control. And Jenny, my science advisor Jenny, has agreed to help me with that, just like she helped me with the Chemtrails book. She was the secret sauce on the Chemtrails book, you know.
The secret sauce, I love that.
Because she made the science, she made the science all correct. I'm not a science guy. If I didn't have her, I'm sure the science, there would have been a lot of wrong things in the science because, you know, it's very technical and precise and all this. Jenny Silcox is a regular on the Wake Up show with Zublik and Penny Shepherd, you know, just like you are. Jenny has been on there. She's been coming on.
Peter, this has been absolutely sensational. I cannot thank you enough. Everyone, check out The Fall of San Francisco, available at Amazon.com. Meanwhile, spend as much time as you can with your family, your friends, the people you love and care about, because we do not know how much time we have left. Thank you.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Peter, that was wonderful.
Join me at the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Industrial Complex podcast here on Revolution Radio, Studio B, every Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Get fit, empowered, physically, mentally, and spiritually.
My name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion.